the term of the only Democratic member expires in the spring. I may add that on two previous occasions there was a long, humiliating period of delay in signing extensions of my trusteeship, and that the last two extensions were reduced from 2 years to one. In a statement issued by his office, Rockefeller paid the required obeisance to Moses' long and brilliant career and leadership. There is no one who has done more to develop parks, not only in this state but anywhere in the nation, than has Commissioner Moses, and the people of this state will forever be indebted to him, he said. The governor tried, at great length, to make the voters understand that he had not sought to end Moses' career, but only to ensure an orderly transition of leadership in one phase of it, a phase that will take years to fully develop. He pointed out at length that Moses was giving up the other posts voluntarily. But contained in the statement was cold Rockefeller anger. It is regrettable that in his statement of resignation to the press, Mr. Moses has made an invidious reference to my brother Lawrence. Lawrence Rockefeller has been associated with the state park system since his appointment by Governor Herbert H. Lehman in 1939 as a member of the Palisades Interstate Commission. The resignations were regretted, but they were accepted. All of them. I don't think Mr. Moses realized what he was doing in the rush that day, Sid Shapiro says. I don't think he really expected the governor to let him resign from all the park posts, and I don't think he ever expected him to let him resign from the power authority. When he did realize it, I think it broke his heart. Moses' statement had gotten him the kind of headlines he wanted. The Times, for example, gave his nepotism charge a big page one headline, but at a terrible cost. At one stroke, he had cost himself five jobs, five on top of the four city jobs he had lost 2 years before. Once, he had held 12 separate posts. Now he was down to two, the chairmanship of the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority and the presidency of the World's Fair. Three, if one counted his informal and, of course, still enormously powerful designation as city representative on arterial highways. And it wasn't the number of jobs he had lost so much as what jobs they were. The Long Island parks, well, they were the thing he had done first, you know, Shapiro says. He loved Long Island more than any other place, and Jones Beach and the rest of those parks, well, they were his baby. It mattered so much to him that they be kept beautiful, just as he wanted them, and that he be able to expand them the way they should be expanded. Nothing else mattered as much to him as those parks, and now he had lost them. And not only had he lost control of his first great dream, he had lost a huge hunk of his power. His power had been derived partly from popularity and mostly from money, money that he had sole discretion to spend. The popularity had vanished some years back, but its loss had not mattered much so long as he didn't lose the money. But the money came from his network of four public authorities. Now, at a stroke, three of them were gone, including the biggest of them all, the State Power Authority, that, with both Robert Moses' power dams completed at last, was beginning to generate tens of millions of dollars in annual revenue. To reporters, he said firmly that the matter was closed. There is nothing I am doing about it, he said with a broad smile, announcing that he was leaving for a previously planned vacation in Puerto Rico, ironically at Lawrence's Dorado Beach Hotel. Moses takes ouster calmly, headline said. But behind the scenes he was maneuvering almost frantically to attempt to retrieve his mistake. His emissaries were working on anyone who had Rockefeller's ear. Van Arsdale and Brennan were soon asking the governor to let Moses withdraw his resignations, even if that withdrawal meant that Moses would have to eat public crow. A man closer to the governor, however, had guessed the futility of such attempts. Moses got friends of mine to come to me and ask me to try to persuade Rockefeller to let him take it back, recalls Thomas E. Dewey. I must have had a dozen phone calls from people I knew, but I had made a discreet inquiry, an indirect inquiry. Rockefeller wasn't going to let him take it back. I felt sorry for him. For what might have been the one reason for Rockefeller to let Moses withdraw his resignations, not his Parks Council resignation, perhaps, but his others, did not, to his surprise and that of political insiders, exist. The expected storm of protest had not materialized. Robert Moses had been fired, and hardly anyone had really cared. Citing nepotism as its cause, the Daily News reacted to the ouster with outrage, as did the Journal American, "We need him," and conservative columnists. No public official in any part of the country is comparable to Robert Moses in his devoted and unending and mostly uncompensated public service for nearly half a century, Georgie Sokolsky declared. No man can be trusted with major affairs who asks such a man as Robert Moses to resign. But in the rest of the media, there was only a brief flurry of editorials, and the editorial that mattered never came. Moses must have known he had lost when, on December 2nd, he turned at his breakfast table to the editorial page of the New York Times, which only 3 years before had said, "You don't bench Babe Ruth," and read, "The most incredible of all the prodigious qualities of Robert Moses has been his ability to sustain, long after most other men retire, a superhuman burden of responsibilities. He has conquered every obstacle in 4 decades of public service, except the ability to make himself immortal. We hope that, after the verbal skyrockets sputter out, he will recognize the wisdom of the governor's suggestion that it was time, indeed past time, to begin planning for an orderly transition of authority. No government function can be made so dependent on a single individual that he becomes the indispensable man." The young reporter assigned to cover the otherwise vacant Newsday city desk Saturday afternoon and Sunday morning, the paper had no Sunday edition then, found waiting for him a memo from an editor telling him to compile a summary of all the statements that the editor was sure would be pouring in for a big story on reaction in governmental circles to be written by state political editor Stan Hinden Sunday night for Monday's paper. But all Saturday, there was exactly one such statement, a brief one from Democratic State Chairman William H. McKeon, charging the governor with cavalier treatment. Telephoning around for comment Sunday evening, Hinden found politicians rather reluctant to make any, and those they did make were carefully hedged. Aside from a few Democratic county chairmen backing McKeon, of a score of public officials telephoned, only Newbold Morris, "I can't believe it," was willing to go on record with the type of public statement the editor had expected. Pragmatists all, politicians had grasped at once the basic reality of the situation. The governor, the man with the power, was the man they didn't want to offend. As for the public at large, aside from a spate, a brief spate of letters to the editor, there was hardly any reaction at all. In political circles, the illusion of Moses' popularity with the voters had lingered long after the reality was gone, partly because in those circles, many of whose members were making money off him, that popularity was undimmed, partly because politicians were close enough to him to be overawed by his personality so completely that they could hardly conceive of his falling into public disrepute. For decades, governors had dreaded what would happen if they had to be the one to fire Bob Moses. Now, one governor had fired Bob Moses, and nothing had happened. The next meeting of the State Council of Parks was the first in 38 years over which Robert Moses had not presided. It was the first meeting of the State Council of Parks ever over which Moses had not presided. At that meeting, his successor read a eulogy with, observers say, obvious feeling. Then resolutions were adopted unanimously to change the names of not one, but 3 separate state parks, one at Niagara, one at Messina, and one on Fire Island, to Robert Moses State Park. At a time at which the naming of public works after individuals had not reached the flood tide it was later to assume, this was an almost unprecedented honor. It is doubtful that any individual below the rank of president had ever had three separate major public works named after him at the same time. Coupled with the eulogy, it made the January 22, 1963 meeting of the State Council of Parks one of unparalleled tribute to Robert Moses. But Robert Moses had not presided over that meeting. More important, he had not been present, for only the heads of the various regional park commissions could attend, and he was no longer the head of the regional park commission he had headed for 38 years, the park commission that represented his youthful and cherished and most nearly perfect dreams. During the following years, Robert Moses never admitted even once, not even to his closest friends, not even to Shapiro, how much the loss of the presidency of the Long Island State Park Commission meant to him. But people who knew him saw through his assured indifference. His successor as commission president, Perry Duryea Jr., son of an old associate and an admirer himself, speaks of the great emotional strain that the 74-year-old commissioner went through when discussing the parks with him. "He always considered the Long Island State Park Commission as his base," Duryea says. "Long Island was, after all, the place he knew best. This was really the Moses baby above everything else." Says Joe Ingraham, "He would never let on, but you could see it in everything he said. They broke his heart when they took that away from him." Not only pride, but politics prevented Moses thereafter from displaying open resentment. Having had a taste of Nelson Rockefeller once, he was not anxious for another one. He was, shortly, to swallow his pride and make up with the man who had so grievously injured him. At the dedication of the Alexander Hamilton Bridge 2 weeks after the firing, reporters were watching to see Moses' reaction when Rockefeller appeared. Moses' reaction was to throw his arms around Rockefeller and to go out of his way to praise him during his speech. Rockefeller threw his arms around Moses and praised him too. Chapter 47. The Great Fair. The New York World's Fair of 1964-65, huge and spectacular though it was, could not capture the imagination of the man who was in charge of it. To him, preoccupied with immortality, creator of public works that would endure for centuries, 2 years, the total duration of the fair, was but a watch in the night. He saw the fair only as a means to other ends. One of these ends was a dream out of his youth that had remained bright in his old age, a dream of a great park, the greatest in New York City, the greatest within the limits of any city in the world, the ultimate urban park, Rus in Urbe Supreme, a park worthy of being named Robert Moses Park. He had been fighting for that dream close to 40 years, using first one expedient and then another to inch it, step by painstaking step, closer to reality, and after 40 years, it was still nowhere close. The fair, he realized at once, might at last be the means to achieve it, for the site of the fair, like the site of the dream, was the Flushing Meadows. Nature had presented the meadows as a gift to the city. 3 miles of marshland, too low-lying and waterlogged for any developer to fill in, so that as the ugly man-made tide called Slurb swept eastward across Queens, engulfing in cheap subdivisions the fields and woods on the higher land bordering the meadows, it broke and ebbed around that marsh, leaving the meadows undivided, whole, still available for the common weal. Man, in the person of Tammany Hall and a character named Fishhooks McCarthy, had done his best to squander that gift. Although the meadows were city-owned parkland, for years the 40 thieves on the city's old Board of Aldermen had allowed Fishhooks Brooklyn Ash Removal Company to use them as a gigantic dump for the burning of the garbage of all Brooklyn. By the 1920s, 110 railroad carloads of the off-scourings of the Borough of Churches, transported on private railroad tracks used exclusively by Fishhook's firm, were being dumped daily onto the meadows, and a once beautiful marshland was covered with foothills of filth. One, nicknamed Mount Corona, towered nearly 100 feet in the air. infested by rats that, Moses was to say, were big enough to wear saddles, and by swarms of fur-bearing creatures so numerous that nearby shanty dwellers eked out livings trapping them and selling them to fur dealers. The once lovely Flushing River had become an open sewer. At night, burning refuse from the Flushing Meadows dumps and from those on Riker's Island just beyond glowed and flamed dramatically. During the day, the scene was ugly enough to inspire the creative mind. It inspired F. Scott Fitzgerald, who in The Great Gatsby described it as a valley of ashes, a fantastic farm where ashes grow like wheat into ridges and hills and grotesque gardens, where ashes take the forms of houses and chimneys and rising smoke, and finally, with a transcendent effort, of ash-gray men who move dimly and already crumbling through the powdery air. Occasionally, a line of gray cars crawls along an invisible track, gives out a ghastly creak, and comes to rest, and immediately the ash-gray men swarm up with leaden spades and stir up an impenetrable cloud. And it inspired Robert Moses. From the 1920s, the Flushing Meadows had fired Moses' imagination. Part of the inspiration had been their size, of course. They were 1,346 acres, a central park and a half. Part had been their location. They lay almost precisely at the geographic center of New York. As the city's population shifted, moving steadily eastward, its population center was moving steadily closer to those meadows, too. A park there, Moses felt, would be a true central park to the whole city. For a man with a vision so broad that it required vast open spaces for realization, here was a vast open space, at the city's geographic and population center. And in some way, the very ugliness of the meadows seemed to furnish inspiration, too. They, and the Riker's dump beyond, were a cloud of smoke by day and a pillar of fire by night, he was to write. Rereading Isaiah, he came across, "Give unto them beauty for ashes." After that, his dream had a slogan. He would turn what may well have been the ugliest part of New York City into its most beautiful. As with all Moses' dreams, this one kept expanding. By 1930, on the maps he prepared for the Metropolitan Park Conference, there was green, the green that symbolized future parkland, not only over the Flushing Meadows, but extending eastward from the meadows in a continuous corridor right along the spine of Queens all the way out to the city line, not just a park, but a string of three parks, Casena, Cunningham, and Alley Pond, connected by strips of greenery, parks designed to serve not only the single-family home Queens of the present generation, but the high-rise Queens he foresaw for future generations. But it was to be a tough dream to realize. No project on which Robert Moses had ever embarked was to document more definitively his statement, "It takes more than a good idea to make a great public improvement. The fact is that such things happen when there are leaders available, ready and eager to take advantage of the logic of events. Even then, the whole result is accomplished only by a series of limited objectives over a surprisingly long period of years." No project was to demonstrate more dramatically that of all the qualities which enabled him to build public works of the first magnitude, none was more important than the simple fact that he endured, that he stayed in power not for years, but for decades. Because it took decades. He began trudging through the park, actively planning it in detail, in 1934, walking through the Valley of Ashes, trudging, as he put it, over 30 years of the off-scourings, the cans, cast-off baby carriages and umbrellas of Brooklyn, among the ash-gray men carrying spades, followed by a group of men without spades, Madigan, Howland, Andrews, Latham, Shapiro, Chapin. Soon there were transoms and plumb lines among the spades, and then blueprints, for, searching for a way to extend the Grand Central Parkway to the Triborough Bridge, he had determined, and the engineers had confirmed, that the way could be along the western edge of the meadows. For a while thereafter, he hoped that the parkway could lead to the park, that the road might prove the key to unlocking the monumental expenditure of public funds necessary for the realization of so monumental a vision. With LaGuardia in, Tammany was out, and so too was Fishhooks. State funds were available to build the parkway, and, cynical as he had become about the ability of the legislative leaders in Albany to see the public interest, he could not believe that even they would allow him to build a road along which motorists would have to drive through hills of garbage. He was sure that once he got the parkway built, he could get state money to build a park around it. But he had underestimated Albany. The legislature would give funds for a road and nothing else. The Grand Central Parkway and a narrow right-of-way on either side of it was all he was able to build on the meadows. He moved 50 million cubic yards of rubbish, but they made in Mount Corona only a narrow pass, recalls Rogers. Motorists still had to pass through the dark wall of refuse before coming out on the broad prospects of meadow and bay. For a while, Moses would recall ruefully, we fondly hoped to cover the garbage with a thin layer of topsoil and to plant at a price which would not subject us to indictment. But obtaining even the topsoil strained his ingenuity to the limit. Planting was out of the question. As for the great park, we studied every possible means of acquiring the whole meadow, but this dream seemed too big for the vision and means of the city in the face of competition of so many other urgent enterprises. Then, he says, in words that reveal that inside Robert Moses the power broker, there was still a Robert Moses the dreamer, the miracle happened. The idea of a World's Fair. Not the 1964-65 World's Fair, the 1939-40. The mind that could grasp an idea in an instant, expand it, fill in its details, see its relation to other ideas, lunged at that idea of the fair as it fell from George McKenney's lips. By God, that's a great idea, he had said, pounding the table. He would sell it to LaGuardia, and he himself would stop at nothing to help, if the fair was held on Flushing Meadows, and if from the beginning the project was planned so as to ensure a great park on the meadows after the fair closed. Moses thought he had taken out every possible form of insurance. His park commissionership made him, in effect, the Fair Corporation's landlord. The lease he drew up, and, as additional insurance, embodied in legislation he had passed in Albany, provided that the improvements necessary to make the meadows usable be permanent, not temporary improvements, and that they be installed in conformance with his plan for the park, right down to the creation of a boat basin at the north end of the site and two lakes at the south. Thousands of trees were planted and thousands of yards of underground utility lines laid according to the landscape design for the park, not the fair. The first $4 million of fair profits, moreover, were to be used as a spark to kindle further state and city contributions to create a park. Making the meadows usable proved to be immensely more difficult than even the most pessimistic of his engineers had foreseen. It was at the Flushing Meadows, for example, that there were encountered, for the first time on such a large scale in the metropolitan area, mud waves of a force that ripped loose foundations and pilings. A new drainage system for the entire Flushing area, which included placing a branch of the Flushing River in a conduit as large as a tube of the Holland Tunnel, had to be created. Cleaning up pollution in Flushing Bay required two giant sewage treatment plants. Even for Moses, the list of other basic improvements required was endless. Even he had to call their total cost, $59 million, staggering. But Moses got the money from Albany, and, with LaGuardia's help, from Washington. He even got an additional $1 million, which LaGuardia found somewhere in the city budget, after Moses promised him that the building would have plenty of the mayor's favorite architectural element, glass bricks, for an Imar Embry-designed, permanent, pillared New York City building housing an ice and roller skating rink. You could get a lot of building for $1 million then, Moses would recall ruefully. And then he saw all his precautions made meaningless by Grover Whalen's inefficiency. The $4 million was supposed to come out of the fair's profits, and there were no profits. the 1939-40 New York World's Fair ended with a deficit so large that it could repay its backers only 33 cents on the dollar. By 1940, federal funds had dried up. The city was broke. All during the 5 years of World War II, the Flushing Meadows remained a park mostly in name only, littered with debris from the buildings of exhibitors who had had enough money to dismantle their structures, but not enough to truck the remains away, grass and trees dying, rats starting to reappear. All that was left was a skating rink, and, underground, invisible, tens of millions of dollars worth of utilities that would provide a foundation for a park, if ever there should come another chance to build it. One event in which Moses saw the logic of using it to progress a park had been a highway. Another had been a World's Fair. It took a leader with his single-mindedness to see such logic in the third, which occurred 5 years after the fair. Other men might see the formation of the United Nations in 1945 as a chance for peace. He saw it as a chance for a park. Persuading Secretary General Trygve Lie to use the city building until UN headquarters in Manhattan could be completed, he got $2 million from the enthusiastic Board of Estimate to remodel it, and enough of that money found its way into remodeling around, rather than in that building, to develop scores of acres near it according to the park plans he had stored away for so many years now. Another 5 years, and another event, and the same park commissioner still around to take advantage of its logic. With the population of Queens burgeoning in 1951, the Board of Estimate approved a huge new storm sewer for the borough. When Moses had finished taking a hand in its planning, it was running along a route linking Alley Pond, Cunningham, and Cassina Parks. Enough land along it had been condemned, so there could be at least a strip of parkland all the way from Flushing Meadows to the city line. Arrangements had been made to fill the gash made for the sewer with sanitation department fill, according to plans drawn up by the park department, and after decades of dreaming about a Queens Park corridor, the land for it was at last in his hands. And when, in 1959, he had first heard that men were planning another World's Fair, he believed that the chance had come to turn the great Queens dream, Flushing Meadows Park, the corridor, the three other parks along it, into reality at last. That was the key attraction for him in assuming the fair presidency. He admitted this fairly frankly in public. "Visitors to such an exposition," he wrote, "carry away indelible impressions, lively lessons, enduring satisfactions, and pleasant memories. But what finally remains in the ground when the pageant has faded, the brickbats have been removed by the wreckers and scavengers, and the park planners have gone to work, is of more concern to the next generation than any spectacle, however gorgeous." In private, he was more frank. "I don't think R.M. really ever cared about the fair, not in the sense that he cared about Jones Beach, say," Sid Shapiro declares. "What he cared about, what he was always talking about, was what the fair could do for parks." The fair could do what he had wanted to do for so long. "The chain of urban parks," he said, "would be the ultimate residuary legatee of the fair." And he was sure the legacy would be large enough. Hardly had he assumed the presidency when the engineering firms of his two most trusted park consultants, W. Earl Andrews of Andrews and Clark and Gilmore Clark of Clark and Rapuano, were costing out the full-scale development of the chain. The figure came to about $56 million, and his financial consultant, Jack Madigan of Madigan Highland, assured him the fair's surplus would be far higher. He went on record with a confident promise. "The fair will finish the Flushing Meadow and Corridor program without cost to the city. The fair management is committed without reservation to presenting to the city an integrated chain of urban parks which will serve as a model to rapidly growing municipalities everywhere. We will build a heritage for all time." There was even a timetable, laid out park by park, and guaranteeing, unconditionally, completion by the summer of 1967, less than 2 years after the fair was to close. The fair would be the instrument by which the dream he had cherished for almost 40 years would be transformed into reality. reality grand enough and beautiful enough to bear his name, as he expected to be identified with it. One of the bankers he appointed to its finance committee would soon be suggesting that the new park must be called Robert Moses Park. Moses did not demur. It was an open secret among his aides that the suggestion was just what R.M. had in mind. The realization of a dream was one end to which the World's Fair represented a means. There were two others, power and popularity. On the single square mile of former garbage dump that would be the actual fairgrounds, a single mile over which Robert Moses possessed sole jurisdiction, there would be spent, by state and federal governments on highways, by city governments on other improvements, by state, federal, and city governments and private corporate grants on exhibits, well over $1 billion. A single item in the first estimate prepared by his office of the money that would be poured into the site gave some idea of the dimension of spending he had in mind. That item was miscellaneous, $55 million. He made sure that that billion wasn't wasted. He distributed it where it could bring the greatest return in power. Maintenance, cleaning, repairs, garbage collection and disposal was obviously going to be a huge item at the fair. Of all maintenance companies in New York, none was better connected politically than the Allied Maintenance Corporation. On March 9, 1964, there went out from fair headquarters a memo. Constable to all participants. Allied has been designated by the Fair Corporation as the only refuse and garbage collectors at the fair. Exhibitors would no longer be allowed to pick and choose among maintenance firms to get the best rates. Allied had been given a monopoly. Allied used that monopoly to the hilt, charging rates so inflated that during the fair's first season alone, the company was to collect from helpless exhibitors more than $10 million. Commissions on the insurance that would be required of exhibitors would come to more than $3 million. Carmine DiSapio, despite his break with Wagner, still possessed considerable behind-the-scenes political power, particularly through his ally, State Democratic Chairman Michael J. Prendergast, in the state capitol, where Moses now needed power more urgently than he had in decades. DiSapio was known to look fondly on an insurance agency named Campo & Roberts, and Article 17 of the fair's General Regulations for Exhibition, with which all exhibitors were bound by contract to comply, required that insurance must be procured from insurance companies approved by the Fair Corporation, and only one company, Campo & Roberts, was approved. Mayor Wagner protested, but in a competition with DiSapio, Wagner was handicapped. He was honest. Commissions wouldn't buy him. The mayor could have asked Moses to give fair-oriented insurance to firms operated by his supporters, but for another handicap, his unshakable resolution never to give Moses something the coordinator could hold over his head by asking him directly for a favor. He had Deputy Mayor Paul Scrivain, the key liaison between the mayor and Moses on the fair, raise the subject, and, Scrivain recalls, Moses would say, as he said on other things that came up during the fair, "Well, for Christ's sake, let him ask for it. I can't do anything for him if he doesn't ask." I used to go back and tell Wagner to name the guy he wanted to get the insurance, but he wouldn't do it. Finally, there was a meeting at Gracie Mansion, just the three of us, Scrivain recalls. Previously, the deputy mayor says, Wagner had been incensed. If, when he had the confrontation with him, he had spoken the way he spoke in private, Moses would have changed the insurance. But Wagner wouldn't. Finally, Moses asked Bob if Bob had someone. Give me a name. But Bob wouldn't tell him. Here is Wagner's recollection of this issue. I didn't see after my battle of 1961 why DiSapio should have the insurance. I said, Bob, I hear DiSapio's got an interest in the insurance. I never got a straight answer. I know from other sources that he did, but I never got a straight answer. Asked why Moses felt an alliance with DiSapio would be more profitable than an alliance with him, The mayor replied by recalling a song once sung by reporters at an Inner Circle dinner, whose key lines, Wagner says, were, "Mayors come and mayors go, but old man Moses, he just keeps rolling along." Insurance commissions were only one of 1,000 fees created by the fair, and it sometimes seemed as if every one of them was distributed according to a single criterion: the amount of power it could purchase for Robert Moses. Others might see the fair as a chance to foster peace through understanding, or to boost the occupancy rate of New York hotels, or to increase sales in New York department stores. Moses appears to have seen the fair as a gigantic gravy train on which he could ride back to the power he had left behind. In those early days, the fair's future appeared as golden as the statue of the Moroni Angel atop the Mormon Pavilion. Ticket sales were going even better than expected. Money was flowing in at a rate exceeding Madigan's most optimistic estimates. Moses was soon boasting that there might be even more money available than he had thought. Soon everyone was scrambling to get on board. One fair corporation executive, speaking of an attitude of affluence at Flushing Meadows, says, "There was Moses talking about all those millions of dollars in advance sales, and the unions and allied said, 'Why should we try to hold costs down? If a guy's making so much dough, why shouldn't we get some of it?'" And Moses helped them on. Lavish spending had always been part of his lifestyle. He certainly wasn't going to change that style now. Unions were allowed, encouraged, to charge exhibitors rates unusual even for New York. Carpenters, for example, received, not as overtime but as normal pay, $23 an hour. The $10 million that Allied was to reap from individual exhibitors during the fair's first season alone might have seemed sufficient for even so politically well-connected a firm, but the contract Moses signed with Allied on behalf of the Fair Corporation was, in that year alone, to hand the company an additional $12 million. The Fair Corporation's original budget for security had been a lavish $5 million a year. But Moses wanted security laid on with an eye not just for safety, but for show. A whole platoon of Pinkerton guards, dressed in elaborate uniforms with white gloves and white ascots, was assigned as an honor guard at fair headquarters, so that when foreign ambassadors or heads of state drove up, Moses could greet them with suitable panoply. During the fair's first year of operation alone, Moses spent almost $10 million for security. He liked to reward his allies on an imperial scale. Politically well-connected PR man Tom Deegan, with his statement that, "I expect to continue to serve without any fees or expenses of any kind," still warm on the record, was given an annual fee of $100,000 and expenses that included a $1,000 a month suite at the Waldorf and a $572 monthly salary for a chauffeur. And that was just Tom Deegan personally. The Thomas J. Deegan Company, Inc. received from the fair an additional $350,000 per year. Not that the Deegan firm was responsible for the whole fair public relations effort. The firm owned by Bill O'Dwyer's canny PR man and still well-connected political insider, Bill Donahue, received $400,000 per year. Then there was Ed O'Brien and Murray Davis, and a list of former newspapermen that ran into the dozens. The listed Fair Corporation expenses for public relations for its first season alone ran to $2,772,542.49. Moses had always liked to pick up checks in the grand style. This predilection was indulged, so that VIP visitors, every politician, it seemed, from New York State or city, their relatives, influential businessmen, architects, engineers, contractors, and their relatives, Moses' whole Yale class of 1909, dozens of neighbors from Babylon, scores of his acquaintances, and of constables, Spargos, Shapiros, of everyone connected in any way with the fair administration, would not be forced to tour the fairgrounds on foot with the hoi polloi. The Fair Corporation purchased a fleet of white sedans and set up a chauffeur's pool in which there were often scores of men sitting around waiting for their next assignment. the chefs and waiters necessary for Moses to host at luncheons in his accustomed style were laid on. As for the scores of cocktail parties and other receptions he hosted, economize was a dirty word, one Fair Corporation executive recalls. During the fair's first season, the bill for reception, travel, and subsistence expenses was $706,053.51. During its first year, the Fair Corporation spent on operating expenses alone $33,299,000, double the original budget. And those expenses do not include the helping hand Moses offered to allies in trouble. One of his Triborough concessionaires had bitten off, in a concession called the Belgian Village, more than he could financially chew. He needed $750,000 in cash, and he needed it fast. Although there was very little chance that it would ever be seen again, and in fact it never was, the Fair Corporation lent him the money. Moses wanted a full passenger list aboard this most luxurious of all gravy trains, not only so that he could have the largest possible audience for his hospitality, but because, more important, a passenger's acceptance of his ticket would couple his fortunes to Moses, make him his ally, help him retain and increase the power he had begun to lose. He wanted power, and to get it he selected his passenger list with care. "Why don't you come aboard?" O'Brien and Donahue were asking. And, Joe Kahn says, "Sometimes it seemed as if everyone who mattered was." The unions, thanks to the exclusive padded contracts, were already snug in their berths. The banks, thanks to $29 million in Fair Corporation bonds, were snug in theirs. And now, in response to Moses' invitations, a substantial portion of the city's power elite scrambled aboard. Contractors, the names on the big signs beside the excavations on the fair site, Tully and DiNapoli, Hendrickson Brothers, Corbetta, Slattery, Johnson, Drake and Piper, DeLillo, Gull, were a roster of political clout. Engineers, Schumavon and Buckley, Parsons, Brinkerhoff, Tibbetts, Abbott, McCarthy, Stratton, and one new name, Blauvelt Engineering, a firm with a new partner, George E. Spargo. Architects, suppliers. The legal fees, immense legal fees, went to Sam Rosenman, and, with the help of Moses-authored legislation exempting the fair from the city's code of ethics, the law firm that former city administrator Charlie Pruce had just resigned to join. The vice president in charge of international affairs was Charles Poletti, called governor because he had once served a 29-day term in that post as Lehman's interim successor. The head of the United States Pavilion was Triborough Commissioner and powerful realtor and political insider Norman K. Winston. Lucrative concessions were handed out to men like Howard Cullman and George P. Monahan, who had been replaced as State Harness Racing Commissioner when the State Investigation Commission revealed that contractors who, on his recommendation, had been given contracts by the harness tracks had repaired his home for free. The lucrative contract for the fair's souvenir program went to Henry Luce's Time, Inc. Other benefits from the fair went to a subsidiary of John Hay Whitney's Whitney Communication Corporation Holding Company. The World's Fair gave Robert Moses $1 billion to spend on power, and he got his money's worth. Proof of that was forthcoming within a very short period of time after he became fair president. Some bankers, remembering the 1939-40 fiasco at Flushing, were reluctant to purchase fair bonds unless the fair could show some operating capital of its own first. Moses asked the city to come up with some. There were plenty of objections from liberals, including city councilmen. Stanley Isaacs was, of course, among them, who said that the city had more urgent needs on which to spend money, but not from the people who counted. The council and the Board of Estimate and mayor hastily approved an allocation of $24 million to the fair, whose purpose had supposedly been to earn the city money, and the $24 million was only the visible portion of the city's contribution. Whenever Moses needed more money, and he needed it often, he went back to the city for quiet contributions. The total city contribution to the fair is hidden under scores of innocuous items. But one estimate, possibly conservative, was that it topped $60 million. The fair got him power. Popularity was something else again. The Universal Exposition should have restored much of the universal affection in which he had once been held, both because its loudly proclaimed end as a great park should have reminded that portion of the public old enough to remember that Robert Moses was primarily a park man, and because a fair was a cause almost as much on the side of the Angels as parks, an event the press would normally cover in a blithe, carefree, favorable vein. It should, in fact, have in a way broadened his popularity, making it national in scope, giving him coast-to-coast publicity. The fair should have rehabilitated Robert Moses' reputation and expanded it. Instead, the fair destroyed it. It was his own fault. In love with power, he could not give it up. To accept this new, bigger construction post, it had been necessary for him to trade in a smaller Title I, but he would not even consider giving up anything else. At the same time that he was undertaking to build the largest exposition the world had ever seen, therefore, he was simultaneously building the world's largest hydroelectric facility, the world's largest suspension bridge, and the world's largest metropolitan arterial highway system, as well as building another huge suspension bridge, acquiring thousands of acres of new Long Island parks, battling on a dozen fronts to win approval of one new highway down Fire Island and two across Manhattan, giving general direction to city and state park programs, and administering a $60 million a year corporation, six bridge, two tunnel triborough, and a $65 million a year corporation, the State Power Authority. Title I had been his first failure, and part of the reason had been the fact that he had simply had too much else to do. Now, thanks to his reluctance to relinquish power, he was stepping into the same trap. He was moving into a new field, one in which he possessed no expertise, and he was allowing himself no time to acquire any. Nor would he hire himself any. His muchachos had built and administered highways, bridges, tunnels, and parks. They had never built or administered a World's Fair. Yet he would not allow outsiders into his operation. Long-time Moses men comprised the fair's entire upper echelon. Its top-level executive staff included not a single person with exposition experience. The man he assigned to sell space in the industrial area was J. Anthony Panic, whose sole qualification appears to have been the fact that his housing reorganization report praised Moses. Panic, as one critic was to note, had never sold anything in his life. 2 years later, Moses was to fire him. He couldn't do the job, he was to say. A nice fellow, but he couldn't do the job. The emissary to foreign governments was not the diplomat needed, but Governor Poletti. Most important, perhaps, he simply was not especially interested in this mammoth enterprise he had undertaken to create and direct. In all his public life, only one field he had entered, public housing, had failed to ignite the imagination that, when ignited, could blaze so fiercely. Now there were two. The fair would catch his imagination later, but not at the beginning, and it was at the beginning that he made a mistake that would later be ineradicable. He was not at that time interested in the fair itself, so he was not interested in fair pavilions, and they were temporary structures anyway. This man who built for the centuries could not be interested in structures that would last 2 years. The great end he had in mind, a great park, would in fact be endangered by any construction the Fair Corporation undertook itself. Most financial analyses of the 1939-40 World's Fair agreed that a prime cause of its fiscal disaster had been Grover Whalen's willingness to build pavilions because there was an exciting idea behind them, and then find that he couldn't recoup the fair's investment through rentals. Moses was determined not to repeat that mistake. Practically the first major decision made about the fair by this master builder was that he was going to build as little of it as possible. He would, of course, build its interior roadway system and do the landscaping, because they would later become part of the park. But of the more than 200 exhibition pavilions, the Fair Corporation would build exactly three. A small administration building, one small, fair corporation-operated pavilion, and an 18,000-seat auditorium for athletic events and outdoor attractions, to be constructed to the cheapest possible specifications. Uninvolved emotionally in the pavilions as he was, he had an additional financial reason to remain aloof. Because rents from his exhibitors would go to his park, he wanted them set as high as possible, and exhibitors weighing high rents would want complete control over their own architecture. He decided, therefore, to give it to them. Each exhibitor would have virtual carte blanche in his pavilion's design and construction. "A fair begins with its buildings," a critic wrote, stating that by his decision, Moses had, in effect, taken himself out of the fair business. Soon, he was to take another step in that direction. Prior to Moses' installation as its president, the Fair Corporation had appointed a design committee of five distinguished architects: Wallace K. Harrison, Edward Durrell Stone, Gordon Bunshaft, Henry Dreyfuss, and Emil Prager, to develop a central theme and plan. To give the fair unity, they proposed housing all its exhibits in a single donut-shaped pavilion a mile around and 1,800 feet in diameter, which would be constructed by the Fair Corporation and in which exhibitors would rent slices. Moses knew something about the design that none of its supporters, including apparently the design committee, knew. Since he had studied the life of Haussmann, he knew that the donut-shaped building had been used at a previous World's Fair, Haussmann's Universal Exposition of 1867. He turned the proposal down, reiterating that there would, by design, be no central plan of any type. So uninterested was he that he wasn't even interested in the layout of the fair. Hardly had he accepted the fair presidency when he commissioned the Port Authority as the fair's agent in selling the 2 million square feet of rentable space set aside in the transportation area. The only instructions given to the Port Authority executive to whom this responsibility was delegated were, "Here are 80 acres. You develop a master plan and sell them." Another commission, a lucrative one, for selling space in the industrial area, was given to an agent of John Hay Whitney. Even his critics had always had to admit that organization was Robert Moses' strong point. The fair would be disorganized, its 200 pavilions a disorganized hodgepodge of 200 different sizes and shapes. Lack of a theme, a sense of unity, was a weakness of the first magnitude. All great expositions of the past seem, as one critic was to put it, to have some reason behind them. Uninterested in a great exposition, interested only in a great park, Moses seemed to feel he could have one without the other. The fair destroyed Moses' reputation also because he had to have his own way about everything, even in a field to which he was the newest of newcomers. He could have his own way in New York, but in putting on a World's Fair, he had to deal with other states and countries, and his arrogance antagonized them. Dealing with scores of foreign nations would have been difficult enough in any circumstances. Governments were constantly falling, cabinets changing. No sooner had one agreed to join the fair than a new one was in power. Sukarno would participate only if Indonesia's pavilion was placed precisely midway between the United States' and Russia's to symbolize its neutrality. West Berlin wanted its exhibit symbolically situated on a traffic island beside that of the United States. Poletti finally persuaded it to accept a less isolated site, one that was still right across from its protectors. Moses made such dealings impossible. Most European nations were members of the Bureau of International Expositions, a Paris-based body set up in 1928 to regulate their number and nature. The BIE had at least two rules incompatible with Moses' desire for a huge profit. Fairs could not run for more than 6 months and could not ask foreign exhibitors to pay ground rents. None of these obstacles was insuperable, as one observer wrote. There was, in fact, a plethora of precedent for the quiet bending of such rules with tacit BIE approval, some of it established by the 1939-40 World's Fair, which had obtained BIE sanction despite its duration and ground rent. While Robert Koppel, the originator of the idea for the fair, forced out by Moses when he took over, had been running the fair, several countries had begun planning informal but lavish exhibits, ostensibly sponsored by national chambers of commerce, but actually financed by government funds. But Moses had made these obstacles insuperable. Arriving at BIE headquarters in Paris, to find them unimpressively modest and BIE officials unwilling to pay immediate and formal obeisance to his demands, he departed muttering audibly about three people living obscurely in a dumpy apartment in Paris. To the press, he bluntly announced, "We are not subject to any rulings." He must have thought he was talking to the New York State Legislature. The BIE directors, however, were not on his payroll. They responded not only by refusing the fair its official sanction, a step which need not have hurt, but by taking the highly unusual step of formally requesting its members not to participate, which hurt plenty. Within weeks, Britain, which had been planning to participate, announced it wouldn't, and so did three-fourths of the British Commonwealth, along with France and Italy. Of all the major European countries outside the Iron Curtain, only one, Spain, defied the BIE and accepted a Moses invitation. With one press conference, he had made his world's fair a fair without Europe. There would be pavilions named for European countries, but they would be cheapjack jobs financed by private promoters. Out of all the world's most important nations, in fact, the fair obtained exactly six government-sponsored pavilions: Indonesia, Egypt, India, Japan, Mexico, and Pakistan. And, as Poletti was indiscreetly to put it, "It's pretty hard to have a world's fair without a lot of international participation." His loss of reputation was his own fault, primarily because the image he created for the fair was one of controversy. A world's fair was not a bridge that the public had no choice but to pay to use. It was a show to which the public had to be persuaded to purchase tickets. The key to the fair's success was, therefore, public relations. It had to be portrayed to the public in attractive colors, as something gay, glowing, exciting. Moses understood this intellectually. The hard-sell public relations effort he launched was perhaps one of the most extensive ever undertaken on behalf of any enterprise except a presidential election. Movies were made, speakers sent out, equipped with elaborate slide presentations to urge Kiwanis, Rotary, and Elks clubs from coast to coast to come to the fair. Television, radio, magazine, and newspaper ads were laid on so lavishly that Moses Fair Corporation would eventually spend a total of $3,260,963 on public relations. And this was no more than a drop in the promotional bucket. The fair would be featured in tens of millions of dollars of paid advertising by such giant corporate exhibitors as Ford, General Motors, and IBM. The Travelers Insurance Company alone staged elaborate come-to-the-fair presentations in 83 cities. But Moses' PR men, aware of his desire for national publicity, did everything they could to influence the press to play the fair in terms of its boss. The Fair Corporation's own publicity was built around Moses, of course. The Time and Newsweek and Look cover stories had not only the Unisphere, but RM on their covers. Light's story was entitled "Everything Coming Up Moses." The hour-long CBS network show on the fair was largely devoted to Moses' career. The local CBS TV show was "The Man Who Built New York." And because fair publicity was built around Moses, it was wasted. The fair's overall image was not a scene of gaiety, but a scene of strife and uneasiness and rage. Moses' decades-long honeymoon with the press of New York City was over, of course. Criticism in Dorothy Schiff's Post was harsher than ever. Even Newsday publisher Alicia Patterson, her admiration for the man unstinted, could not go on supporting the man's transportation policies. Newsday revealed her ambivalence. Even as Jack Altschul was being relieved of his duties as city editor for 2 weeks to enable him to research thoroughly an admiring three-part series entitled Wizard of the Fair, its editorial page was saying, "The commissioner's arguments lack the good old Moses logic." The editorial was incorrect. The logic of Moses' arguments was the same old Moses' logic. It was the editorial understanding of that logic that had been altered. The times, it was a-changing. Iphigenie Sulzberger's opinion of this man of vision, this giant, had not changed. But she was as scrupulous as ever in her determination not to interfere too overtly in the paper's news coverage and editorial policy. And with Moses' old